For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. This podcast is recorded and produced on the lands of the Djabal and Djerriwarr peoples. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, their elders past, present and emerging.
The entire Australian health system is based around general practice. It's so fundamental to the way that healthcare is delivered in the country. And if we have a situation where clever young doctors and clever new graduates don't want to do general practice as a country, I think we've got to turn this around as a high priority.
That was the voice of Professor Steve Robson, the newly elected president of the Australian Medical Association, talking about what his priorities are for his coming term in office. We sat down for a chat when Professor Robson was fresh from a bout of COVID-19, so I very much appreciate his willingness to fight the fatigue to give me his views on the current hot topics in medicine. Congratulations on your election. What made you decide to run? I mean, you've been in medical politics before. You've been president of the college.
It's a very, very interesting question, Kate, because initially it was not something that was on my radar in any way. In fact, I was thinking maybe I've done enough here and somebody else run with things for the moment. But I had a few people that I like and I trust and I know suggest that I run. And I thought about it deeply, and if I commit to something, I like to commit completely. So in the end, I thought it's not often that you have the opportunity to stand up at a point in time where there's a lot going on and you have a sense that you could actually make things better. So after a bit of reflection on things, I decided to run. And I think the other thing that really made me excited was that Dr. Danielle McMullen, Danny, was wanting to run as vice president with me. And she's a fantastic person, a great doctor, and a great leader. And I think I actually got inspired to join a team with Danny, and that probably got me well and truly over the line. And I'm delighted that I did that and I had the chance to run with Danny.
It is a difficult time, certainly a very interesting time in terms of, particularly in terms of general practice. I know you and Danny have already said publicly that you want to make general practice a bit more of a priority for the AMA going forward. What do you think the problems are and why do you want to focus on it?
When I was a kid, I grew up in a tiny little town in rural Queensland called Mundubbera that nobody's ever heard of. It had a population of about 1,500 people and I think still has a similar population. And when I was a kid in the early 70s, our doctor was a wonderful gentleman called Graham Rolls, who is still consulting in Mundubbera all these years later. And Graham came to town and he was young and he was enthusiastic. And he was one of those people, I remember, that when you saw him, when you were around him, you felt everything was going to be okay. And I'm sure you know people like that as well,
sure,
Kate,
yeah,
from your own work, that there are some people that just you think, oh, you know, everything's going to be okay. That person is here. And I think a lot of Australians have felt that about their doctor, their GP over the years. But it's become clear that with inflation and a lack of indexation of the MBS and corporatisation, I think, of many aspects of general practice, that relationship that so many of us had with our GP is in many cases eroded and gone. And I think when I talk to medical students and younger doctors in training who should be looking enthusiastically at general practice, they say, oh, you know, doesn't look very good. You know, it's really hard work. You've got to grind people through. And the GPs I speak to aren't very happy about things. And they seem discouraged. And they seem like it's not a career choice for them. And I think the problem is that the entire Australian health system is based around general practice. It's so fundamental to the way that healthcare is delivered in the country. And if we have a situation where clever young doctors and clever new graduates don't want to do general practice as a country, you know, as people. I mean, I'm worried about my own health. If myself and my family can't have access to a general practitioner, I think we've got to turn this around as a high priority, Kate.
Do you think bulk billing is dead?
Look, I think, is it dead? No, but are we kind of getting out the defibrillator? I think we're getting close, aren't we? The example I give is from Canberra, where I live and work and have for 20 years. There was a project called the National Health Co-op. It was a venture in which co-op team received an enormous amount of funding from the ACT government. Families would pay a subscription to be part of it, and all their care was meant to be bulk billed. And they went spectacularly broke. And I think it illustrates that even with people subscribing, even with being very busy as they were, and even with literally seven-figure, as I understand it, I could be wrong, but seven-figure sums pouring in from the government, if you can't run a practice and stay solvent, what hope has the average practice got? And I think it just makes no economic sense to try to run a practice on bulk billing alone. And this is unfortunately the situation. I think the big problem is the people who need most care, the people who spend so much time with their GPs, are people with complex chronic conditions. Often their financial circumstances are not so good. They're the ones that you want to bulk bill, that it makes it so hard for them. And it's just such a catastrophe for so many people with chronic conditions, and people have to go to the doctor a lot. Okay.
Is the answer as simple as doubling the rebate? Is the answer lying in funding for Medicare, or is the answer in mixed model billing?
I think a lot of the answers are captured in the 10-year plan for primary care, and the AMA is certainly behind that. And it was certainly endorsed by the previous government, but they didn't put any money into it. And it was Omar and Chris in the election campaign who convinced the current government to commit funding to support the 10-year plan. And it's got a lot. I mean, it's about giving patients a home, placing them with a general practice, and then resourcing a general practice to provide the services they need. And it's also about data, because we all say that health expenditure is an investment. It's not a cost. But we have a responsibility to prove that to the government and say that high quality, properly resourced general practice keeps people healthier. It keeps them out of hospitals. It makes their transition from hospital out easier. It reduces waste and duplication in care and things like that. So what has been obtained is a down payment, and it's 800 and something million over 4 years. So it's it's a lot of money, but it's not going to solve all the problems. But I think it's a down payment. And if the task force the minister set up can do its job properly and bed down a lot of this stuff, I think it's going to lead to improvements. And importantly for the profession, we'll be able to prove that it leads to improvements in care and outcomes.
There's a lot of angry GPs around. A lot of it is about respect. You're another kind of specialist. You're an OBGYN. Do you sense that respect for GPs from other specialties is lacking, or is not perceived by GPs?
I obviously can't speak for all GPs, but I look at it this way. I just am such a massive fan of general practice, because I know that my family can go there and I can go there. And I get a dressing down from my GP because I haven't exercised enough and I haven't checked my blood pressure or whatever. But it's a good dressing down, and it means they're really looking after me. And it's just a comprehensive way to really have your health managed and prioritize screening and all sorts of the things that you need to do. And I'm a massive fan of general practice, and I'm blessed to have a fantastic GP myself and that my family see. And I think individually, you know, people who've got a great GP really love them, but there's a sense if you are a GP that the government does not value your contribution at all. And we've seen a lot of this in the pandemic, where announcements were made about what GPs would be doing, and they'd have enormous implications for general practice. And people would read about it in the paper, and some of them would have massive implications for the way that you run a general practice. And I think with general practitioners putting such a massive effort into the vaccination rollout and all of the things that they do to be, you know, have this metaphorical slap in the face from the government that we don't value you, we don't respect you enough to even tell you what we're doing or include you in discussions about things that we're going to do. I suspect it's more about the government than people, because I think in general, most people love their GP, and I don't get any sense at all of any antagonism or lack of respect between non-GP specialists and GP specialists. I think it's a big team effort, and I'm always constantly talking to GPs about things.
Let's talk about COVID, the big fat elephant in the room. How are you feeling about the not just the government, but the CHOs, the public health response at the moment? It feels a little bit like we might be past the winter peak, but that doesn't mean we're done. You know, there'll be other waves. Are you happy with the way we're mitigating this transmission and infection?
It's a really good and it's just such an important question for the community. And I think we know all the systematic reviews tell us that using good quality masks and not those sort of floppy, cheap surgical masks that people wear as a bit of a fig leaf, but properly fitted masks, you know, N95 masks and so on, that proper distancing and in particular dealing with air quality are really fundamental. And it doesn't matter what variant of the virus you have, they're things that will work for every single variant that you can throw up. So that combination of, well, you know, keeping people vaccinated will stop them getting really sick and reduce the chance they'll end up in hospital, but it doesn't seem to stop them getting it and transmitting it so much. But all of these other things do, and they're really important. And I sense the chief health officers around the country in the states and territories know it, and they give the advice. But politically, it's difficult advice for governments to enact. And particularly when we saw with the Omicron wave, the New South Wales government just essentially let everyone run free on the prairie. It sends a message that it's not important. And there's this disconnect between what people are seeing and reading in the paper and hearing on the radio and what healthcare workers see when they go to work. They think, you know, this is baloney. My emergency department's chock-a-block with people either with COVID or worried they've got COVID, and we're ramping outside and we've got no beds and the staff have got COVID and they can't come to work and we can't put a roster together. So this disconnect, and I think we've really got to start this dialogue again with the government on how we deal with this politically. And I understand a reticence to stir up protesters. I mean, we had all these people in Canberra and those crazy protests and so on. So I get they don't want to stir that up, but there's got to be a better middle ground.
Everybody seems a bit phobic about the mandate word.
Yep.
If the protesters are what we're worrying about, and if that's what's stopping governments mandating, aren't we just worrying about a very loud, tiny minority? shouldn't we be going back to the principle of public health, you know, hope for the best, prepare for the worst?
I think it's just such an important principle, and I don't know where we lost that. I think that over time, and I totally get everybody being so over this. I mean, we're sort of 2.5 years in.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem to be an end in sight, despite what certain people might tell you. We're reading about new waves. And in fact, the data from China today about some new virus that appears to have been transmitted from animals to,
exactly,
to humans. So we have copped a terrible time, but the concept that if we all were vaccinated or got it, that everyone would be immune and it would go away has proven to be a fallacy. We've got to work with the public and say, look, we don't want this going on any more than you do, but it's not going to go away unless we all work together on this. And it, that may mean for the foreseeable future, accepting the fact that in certain settings, you will have to wear a properly fitted mask and you'll have to do this or that or the next thing. And as unpopular as it is, if you want it to go away, you're just going to have to do this.
I'm chatting today with AMA President Professor Steve Robson about what his priorities are for his coming term. In another AMA link, next week I'll be chatting with Dr. Keen Seng Lim, who was honoured with the AMA's 2022 Excellence in Medicine Award recently. That episode will be the fourth in our Voice of the GP series. To get that episode and all future episodes in your inbox, you can subscribe to our feed by searching for Medical Journal of Australia on your favourite podcast platform. And of course, you can catch up with our back catalogue at mja.com.au/podcasts, where they are all free to access. Back to our chat with Steve. Let's talk a little bit about the AMA itself. I don't think it's any big secret that membership isn't as high as you'd like it to be. What's the secret, do you think, to convincing more doctors to join up and to join what is essentially their union?
It's another really good question. And during the AMA presidential election, we all spent a lot of time thinking about this issue. I graduated from medicine embarrassingly a long time ago in 1987. And in those days, it was just sort of the thing that you did. You graduated and you joined the AMA because that's what doctors did. And it was part of the practice of medicine, the way that things are done. And like all member organisations and a new generation of people, that sort of trend to automatically joining things has gone. I first joined as a medical student and have always valued my membership. And I think being a part of it gives you a huge voice through the AMA. And the AMA is, I think, every single doctor, every single medical graduate, no matter where you trained or where you work or what you do, should look at the organisation and see part of themselves reflected in it and give you a sense of identity and a voice that you can have. Like all member organisations, you know, we could always have more members. I think part of it is selling the value proposition. And one of the things that happens, I'm sure you realise this, Kate, with the AMA is that a rising tide lifts all boats. So wins that the AMA have for general practice or private practice or whatever will play out for you a lot of the time, whether you're a member or not. But I think if we allow state and territory AMAs they know what appeals and is important to their constituencies. That's important. And I think two other really big things are that transition from pre-vocational training, from being a doctor in training to being in a vocation, whether it's a GP specialist, non-GP specialist, whatever you do, is a time when we often get a bit of drift away of membership. So making that transition more seamless and encouraging people to stay as members. And also a personal conversation. I mean, if every member just talked to someone and said, I'm a member because of the following, I think you should join, you know, I think that's another valuable thing we shouldn't anticipate. So I just think it's a part of how we do things, you know, how you think and do things, your ethics, the sort of the way that you think as a doctor is woven into the AMA. So that's why I'm enthusiastic about it. But it's obviously an ongoing issue for all of us.
You mentioned the state and territory AMAs. What's the relationship like between the state-based groups and the federal AMA?
I think it depends a little bit on the state or territory. And I think things are a lot better than they were a little while ago. A huge amount of work has been put into making sure that it's a really smooth and functional and friendly and workable relationship between the state and territories. I'm sure you know that the Victorian AMA has had views that probably aren't shared by the board of the federal AMA, and there's been some attempts to sort this out between the board of Victorian AMA and the board of the federal AMA. I'm confident it will be sorted out, and I think in the end the things that really glue the organisation together ultimately will prevail. But I'm not suggesting that there isn't a little bit of work to do working that relationship and getting it running smoothly again, Kate.
What are your hopes for the relationship with the new health minister and the aged care minister, Mark Butler and Annika Wells? Are you familiar with them? Have you chatted with them before?
Yes, I've had good chats with Mark Butler, the Minister for Health and Aged Care, and Jed Keeney, who is the Assistant Minister. Personal chats. And I think broadly we all recognise the same issues and have the same priorities. How you go about dealing with that is what the politics of this is all about. And being the AMA president and working with your vice president is about building the relationship with those people to deliver for the profession and to deliver for Australians in general, so that we have the opportunity to put our side and say, we think the following is important for the Australian health system because of X, and part of your job, your role, is to build the relationship so that people trust the advice you give and to look to work together to solve big problems. And there's no doubt there's plenty of big problems. And I think things never go so well if there's a poor or strained relationship between the AMA leadership and state and territory and federal health ministers. But, you know, even if it's a good relationship, it doesn't necessarily mean things go well, but I think there's a much higher chance of things going well. And my initial impressions of Mark Butler and Jed Keeney in particular are really positive. Now, how that plays out, I don't know, but we seem to get on so far, and the hard work hasn't necessarily started yet. I'm really hopeful of building relationships and delivering for health in this country.
Indigenous health, what do you see as the priorities? Is it about supporting the voice to Parliament? Is it about those big issue, the Uluru Statement of the Heart? Or are there specific things you want to see happen?
There's always the difference between what you think personally and what you represent for the organisation. So on a personal level, I'm strongly in support of a voice to Parliament, but that is a personal feeling about about this. I think we're great, and we've got an Indigenous working group within the AMA, and we're in the process of planning that first meeting. And I'm a very big fan of listening to First Nations Australian doctors and First Nations Australian healthcare workers and let them guide me about what they see as the way forward. And my job is to do everything I can to support what they want being enacted and being done, and amplifying their voice and making sure that they are a part of the discussion and the decision making. And I think on a personal level, I'm keen to get away from a sense of First Nations Australians as victims per se. And I really want to celebrate all the fantastic things about this incredible culture that's existed for so long, and make sure that that voice is heard and influences how things are done. And I know from my own work that we want the next generation of First Nations Australians to get the best start in life. So I've been very, very keen to be involved in how we care for people during pregnancy and birth to give them the absolute best start in life. But we've got some phenomenally hardworking, smart, gifted First Nations Australian doctors now, and I really see them as the ones who need to give us the leadership. And my job and the organisation's job is to work with them, learn from them, listen and promote and give a voice to the agenda that they give me. I'm totally respectful of what they want to do. And there's plenty to do. When we looked at the Closing the Gap data, it was extremely disappointing. Only about four of them were likely to be met, which meant that the vast majority were not going to be met. And that's really disappointing. So there's a lot to do, but we can be there and amplify voices and do everything we can to make sure that they're heard and they have influence.
What's first cab off the rank? What are you up to in the next couple of weeks, say?
I got a bit stymied by having COVID for my very first
yes.
week. I think the absolute first things that have to be out of the blocks are the Strengthening Medicare Task Force and looking at that, how we can move forward with the 10-year plan. I'm very anxious about the welfare and well-being of healthcare workers in this country, and I don't just mean doctors, I mean nurses, paramedics, everybody who's providing yeah. healthcare in the country. So I've had discussions about what we can do about this and how we can make sure our voice is heard as a broad group of healthcare workers. There are challenges, obviously, with public hospitals and ramping and logjam and the enormous pressures that are on all of us who work in public hospitals, and, of course, keeping people, if people can have procedures or care in a private setting, how we can make sure that that works smoothly. We've already had big problems with Bupa and Ramsay being unable to reach agreement and patients unable to receive care and problems on that front as well. And of course, the ongoing response to COVID. So there's a pretty big workload of things. And of course, across all of that, last night we had a fabulous webinar about climate change, because as COVID is an issue now, so climate change is going to be another global massive issue for health, and that's something of which I'm extremely keen to work on. So it's like a pretty big inbox at the moment, Kate. I think one of the things that my friend and colleague Nick Talley, who is well known to everybody, I'm sure very well known to yes. you, talks about is people who just don't believe or put credence in science. And Nick gave a fabulous talk about how this applies with the data that we have about climate change in the webinar last night. But I think more broadly, and we were talking earlier on about protesters and people who don't believe the data about vaccination, or even people who don't believe COVID is a problem and who debunk and don't believe, or try to debunk and don't believe climate change. There's almost a willful scientific illiteracy.
Yes.
And science has delivered so much in terms of health and well-being and the way we live our lives. It's extraordinary that in some senses I almost get a feeling that we're going backwards. And I would really love to do what I can to just improve that engagement with science, to put a public face on science, and to really re-engage people and restore in some way faith. And it's not something I can do personally, but I think in terms of something that I think we need to do as a society globally, is say, you know, science brought us so much. And yeah. we need to engage with it and believe it and harness it and use it and not debunk it, decry it, make light of it or talk it down or willfully ignore it. And I think one of the things I'd love to have some small contribution to, Kate, is just getting people back into supporting science and understanding it, believing it and using it to make all their lives better. And I think if I could make even a tiny contribution to that, that would be something I'd be really proud of.
Thanks, Steve.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.